Hello, I'm Penina from Circle Care Services, and welcome to My BCBA Life. Circle Care Services is an ABA therapy agency, and we're all about giving BCBAs the support and community you're looking for. With this podcast, you're not on your own anymore. You're part of a BCBA community committed to making this world a better place to BCBA. Once this episode is complete, you'll be able to obtain a free CEU certificate for the clinical topic discussed. You'll need to confirm your attendance by taking note of the three surprise words I will drop throughout this episode. There is a link in the show notes below of a form that will ask you for your information and the surprise words that we need to generate your CEU certificate. Thank you, and let's get started. Hi, Samantha. Welcome to My BCBA Life. I'm so excited to have you here. I don't always meet with Circle Care exclusive BCBA, so this is special. So if you could just start by sharing who you are, how you got into BCBA life, and whatever else you think you want the listeners to know about you.
Thank you for having me. I got into ABA right about at the end of my undergrad, going into grad school. So I started off with an internship my last year of undergrad at a school for kids with disabilities, so autism and multiple disabilities. And I worked with a social skills teacher, and I absolutely loved it. You know, that's where my passion really started. I found that I really enjoyed working in a school setting, like teaching kids these types of skills. So then I went on to grad school, and my master's is in cognitive science and education. And then I did the ABA track, like the verified course sequence, and became a BCBA a few years after that. So a lot of my experiences have been either in schools or school adjacent curriculum writing, things like that. So it's something I'm really passionate about. I also do, obviously, you know, work with my home cases, but I always try to integrate either, you know, what they're working on in school or just keep that in mind.
When you went to, like when you did your undergrad, you always had knew that you wanted to become the BCBA, or it developed like as you were just exposed to more education?
It really developed as I was exposed to more. I have my undergrad in psychology, so I knew I wanted to do something with psychology, but I really didn't know what. I was looking into all the options. You know, there's clinical psychology, counseling, school psychology. I initially really thought I was going to go for school psychology. That's what I applied to grad school for at first, and then I ended up switching, and my master's program offered the ABA track. So I decided to do both, and that's where I got introduced to explicitly ABA, and then I looked back at my experience that I had the year before and realized so much of what that social skills teacher was doing was ABA-based.
Wow. That's nice that you had, like, did the social skills teacher know she was doing ABA-based, or it just happened?
I think she did know. She'd been in the field for a very, very long time. It was at least probably 20 years at that point for her. And for me, this is almost 10 years ago, which is wild to say.
Wow.
But she wasn't a BCBA or anything. So I think it was a lot of ABA principles. And since it was a school that had kids with like multiple disabilities and autism, a lot of what they did was ABA based.
You know, that's what's so nice about ABA, because like when someone just educated with the basic principles, then it really does make sense. You know, it's like the science of behavior, and someone could be like, well, the science of behavior, it sounds so complicating. But at the end of the day, it's common sense. And I think that's why so many BCBAs, so many I talk to, I don't know if you listen to like all these episodes, all you hear is like, I felt a lot of people say, I fell into it by mistake. Like, it just sounded so good.
Totally.
And it's so true and so real. And it's just giving you the education you need to like really be able to connect with kids and bring out the best in them in such a natural way. It really is
absolutely
amazing.
Yeah. I tell that with my parents that I work with all the time. I'm like, so much of what you're doing naturalistically now probably is ABA based, right? It's like, it is a science of behavior. It's just obviously how we apply it. But yeah, it's so cool to see in like an education setting like that. It just, it really has an impact on the kids. And I do think, especially kids with autism or like any other neuro differences, it works really well, like teaching kids explicitly like that. Yeah.
Yes.
The first surprise word is sunshine.
And because you already started to go towards our topic that we're talking about today,
right.
You do have a lot of experience in the school-based setting. And a person could just go in and apply their EBA, go home, and, you know, do their best. But there's so much more if you come in knowing how you could really make a difference in the school setting. And a big point that we're going to talk about today is collaborating with school personnel to really maximize what you could offer in a school setting. So yeah. Take a step back and talk about when you say collaborating with school personnel, maybe just go into what does it look like? Why do you feel it's important? And we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll talk about it a little bit from the perspective of when I've worked in schools, and then we can talk a little about what it looks like when you're like a home BCBA, maybe collaborating. But when I have been in schools before, for me, collaborating looks like really keeping an open mind, right? Like the school is such a different environment than a lot of other places, like the home or out in the community. And there's a lot of different factors that impact a kid's day. But when you're collaborating with other professionals, you know, you have people potentially with a special education background, even a general education background, that are really not familiar with ABA or special ed at all. Then you have like speech therapists, OTs, potentially admin. Like there's such a wide range of people that work in a school. But I always like to come in listening, right? So I try to learn, what is the school environment like? What are the dynamics between everybody? What is the classroom like for the kid? As a behavior analyst, I think it's really important to keep that like observation piece in mind, right? Sometimes, and I know I can catch myself doing it where I come in and I'm like, oh, I see X, Y, and Z, and I have a million things to offer or like thoughts on it already. But I always have to hold those back a little bit and be like, okay, let's get a full picture of everything. Let's make a connection. Like, let's pair with the teachers. Let's even ask them about their day. Like, hey, how's it going in the class? For service providers, that might be like, hey, how are your sessions going? Are there, you know, anything that come up that you might want some support with? Would you like me to come observe? Just kind of getting a lay of the land. Yeah, along with that, I just always want to make sure that my presence is positive. You know, I never want it to be like another person coming into your room. You already have a million things to do and you just don't have the time or like anything to deal with somebody else. I want it to be like, hey, I'm here to support you. Sometimes you might just need to vent for a little bit. I'm here to listen. And then once we have that relationship established, then we can start moving into more like, hey, this is what I see. I have some ideas on that. And if you start giving advice before that's established, there's a huge chance it's not going to work, right? They don't want to do it. They're not going to listen. They don't have that buy-in.
So I guess what you're honing in on now, before you go on and share your expertise, is really building the relationship with them so that they trust you.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. So, just how we deal with our learners, like it's important to do with the other staff as well.
Totally, totally. And I just want, like, one thing you said where, like, you come into a classroom and you're like, and you already start, you know, like, that I would never do like that. And why she's doing that, it's totally counterproductive. And I find whenever, like, a person is educated in something, it's very easy to be judgmental towards how other people are doing things. Like, what are you doing? Like, that's, like, totally not, you know, it's you're trying to get here and you're basically, in ABA terms, you're reinforcing the behavior. You're trying to get rid of it. You know, it's very easy to pick that up. And just, I think part of the pairing is probably to be as non-judgmental as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when we have that, you know, education piece where we might all of a sudden just, we see it so clearly, right? Somebody else might not, but we never want them to feel like what they're doing is wrong. And we always want to come from a place of understanding, like, you know, everyone's always going to care. The teachers care so much about their students, right? And it's always coming from a good place. So they might be using an intervention that maybe isn't the best, but we never want to immediately judge them on that. And then even when we do eventually provide the feedback, like we want to provide it in a way that's positive and constructive, right?
The second surprise word is bread.
Exactly.
Exactly. And the whole idea of getting feedback is so that they listen. And obviously you want to catch them at a time where they're open to listening to you rather than just like, oh, here she is again giving all her thing. Like, she thinks she's better than me. And it's even like the nicest person who's just more educated and wants to, like, of course, you think everyone wants to know these things. If she would know it, then wouldn't running her classroom be easier? But especially if a teacher's been doing the same thing for years and years on end, and they all of a sudden have this other person, like just, you know, an observer, you're supposed to help this kid. You're not coming to, you know, change the way I do things. I do things the way I do, you know. It's for sure a huge, huge factor in getting anywhere with kiddos in the classroom.
We probably won't see much success without having that first piece.
Totally. So talk about more, there's besides for the teacher when it comes to the kids, or maybe you, who else do you feel like is important to build a rapport to get the most out of the kid?
Definitely the other service providers at the school, right? So OT, speech, PT, anybody who is providing, you know, direct services. A lot of times kids that I've worked with in the past that have behavior plans, they also have behaviors during these sessions, like the other service provider sessions. So I think it's really, really important when you're either starting in a school, say you're consulting in, or you have a client that, you know, you're working with at a center or daycare, you just establish a relationship and that rapport with the service providers as well. And something that's a little bit different in that respect than the teachers is understanding that everybody has their own discipline, right? So they might have different approaches to things that might not look like ABA, and that's okay. So we never want to come in and say, like, ABA is the only way, like, the way that I'm going to do something is right and you are wrong. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't do that, but it can sometimes happen. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that there are other ways to approach things, like other evidence-based practices, and have that, like, mutual respect with the service providers.
Absolutely. I'm just curious, have you ever, like, because you are so, this is important to you, to have this open mutual conversations with these other service providers, were there ever something that you were able to learn from a different kind of practice that you now incorporate in your own, the way you deal with children? I'm curious if you can give a few examples, because I find that so interesting.
Yeah, me too. Especially, I worked with some OT providers, and one of my good friends, she's an OT, and we talk about it a lot. But just learning about sensory processing, and for some of my kids that, especially younger, they have such like a need for sensory input. And for us as BCBAs, you know, that's something we're not really taught about. Like, we learn about autism, but we don't learn about specifically sensory needs. And sometimes that can even look like to us stimming, but it's actually like a way for them to get input. So a good example of like a concrete behavior is a kid that likes to climb on things inappropriately. Now, for me, I'm like, oh, maybe we're just reinforcing it. But if it is automatically reinforcing, what about that is reinforcing? And I've talked to OTs about it, and it's finding other ways to get that sensory input that that behavior is providing. So that might look like doing obstacle courses, like making ones up, you know, in at home, if it's at home, or in the classroom. It could be carrying, you know, something that's a little bit heavier down the hallway for their break. So rather than just going on a walk, they could carry something, I think it's like around 15% of their body weight, like a few books down the hallway, and that can be really regulating. So for me, that was so interesting. I never thought to use a replacement behavior in that way, but it's totally changed how I approach, rather than just, you know, not reinforcing that behavior or reinforcing alternative behaviors. It's like, what exact replacement behavior should I be looking at that actually targets the need that the kid is going for?
Wow, that's amazing. And I want to take a couple of steps back, because we talked about collaborating and we talked about peering, that the only way to collaborate really is by peering. Like, I think that's like, you know, you can't collaborate if you're not, if you don't have a relationship with the person you want to collaborate with. And they might not feel the need as much as we do in the classroom, but if you know it's a need and it will help your client do a lot better in A, B, and C, then peering is, it's the only way to be able to collaborate, I think, is like a lot what you're saying. But Why would a BCBA want to collaborate in the first place? If I'm working with my kiddo and we're having an amazing behavior plan, we're getting through the goals in school, so I'm happy about that. Why would I want to collaborate with school? And also, why would I want to collaborate with the school if I'm not providing services in the school, which you kind of mentioned already a little bit? Like, you first went into while you're in school, I hear more because you're in the classroom. But if I'm providing ABA at home, why would I want to collaborate with school personnel?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for me personally, and I think, you know, this can be really important in services, is at home, you're providing services for their home environment, but they are spending so much of their day, kids who are school aged, in school. So I do think it's really, really important at the very least to at least, you know, have a touch base with the school, have an understanding of what they're working on. Just make sure you know what their day-to-day looks like. And that can look like getting a copy of the IEP from the parents. So that's something I usually like to do. And I think it's really important because it just gives you insight to what the kid is working on in school, what their progress has looked like, you know, potentially over the last few years, you can see that. And then anything that they might be working on, you know, in school that maybe you're trying to work on at home. So that can be really helpful. So for me, it's helped me identify potentially like gaps between the environment. So I've had some learners that aren't as functional with their communication at home, but have a little bit more at school. So it's looking at, okay, should I work with their speech therapist or their teacher and say, what's been really effective? Have you tried this intervention already? Rather than me, you know, trying it, maybe it's not working, trial and error. It can just, you know, it could speed the process up. And then also I know that the kid knows it, right? So they might know how to select between two pictures of two items that are specifically in school. And maybe I try that at home, have the items as well, and then generalize it to other things in the environment and at home. So I think it can be really helpful with supporting our interventions and just, you know, understanding what they're also working on for the other part of their day.
Totally. What other, like, what skills do you think that are taught at home that are so important for school or vice versa that is, you know, is probably being worked on in school? And that was one example you gave of how, like, you're able to use that in the home environment also. But is there any other skill that's either, like, hyper-focused in each environment that you think, like, a communication could really make a difference?
Yeah, I do think, you know, not quite exactly the skills, but behavior plans. So certain things that have worked in schools, or vice versa, say it's worked at home and they're struggling with it at school. So I've had one client that he had a lot of property destruction at home. And at school, it was basically eliminated. So we kind of saw that behavioral contrast, right? There is a potential that, you know, since he's not doing it at school, he's doing it more at home. But I thought it was helpful to talk to the parents, talk to the school and say, hey, what intervention did you put in place? Because, you know, what we've tried so far at home isn't working. Maybe there's something else we can do. And they had, you know, a really good DRA plan, and we were able to carry it over into home, and it was starting to be more effective with him. So that was something I think, you know, is really useful and powerful. And I would say also social skills is a big one. So at home, we do have different social skills that the kids might be working on, you know, potentially with siblings or with parents turn-taking. But there are a lot of opportunities for social skills at school as well. So I think that's another area that we can look into for our interventions. You know, what do they do in school that's helpful for that? Is there any opportunities for generalization, things like that?
Yes, I can imagine social skills specifically, like what opportunities are they at home? And if they're not engaging well with their oldest child, the older sibling or younger sibling, does it mean that they don't have the skills they need at school? So if you're spending, I think like the speeding it up and just being efficient is just, you know, that's so important. Like you said, you could have spent so many weeks doing trial and error, figuring out how to work with that child's behavior, but in school they already figured it out.
Yeah, right. So like why reinvent the wheel at that point? We know that it was effective with him. And usually parents are pretty excited about that as well. Almost every time I've worked with a school, the parents are like, very happy that I've been collaborating with them. I think for them, you know, it gives them peace of mind too, to know that their service provider teams are all aligned.
For sure. You know, and I think it takes like humility on your end to like be so open to hearing what they said. Like you said, like you don't want to reinvent the wheel, and it could be easy to fall into the trap of like, oh, this is my challenge. Let me see what I could do with my knowledge. Like, why am I asking the teacher? She doesn't have a BCBA and she's not certified in anything. Like, I kind of have the same education as her. What would she have to offer? But like really realizing that everyone has so much to offer. And although you have this kind of experience, she has also a lot of experience working with children. What do you have that could work for me? And I could imagine that, I think, is always like when I see someone who has so much humility, I have such an easier time trusting them, because you know that where they can't provide, they'll let you know because of that humility. So I think besides where the parents appreciating that you're all aligned, just being able to work with someone who they know has their child's best interest in mind, because you're putting all your whatever you have on the side and saying like, what is your child like? It just shows how much you're in it for the child. It really does, which is incredible for the parents to see.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of us are, right? Like, we can get caught up in that. And, you know, sometimes it's fun feeling like you figured out the challenge, for sure. I think that's a piece of it as well. But just keeping it in mind that, like, you know, this is this kid's life. And also, depending on when I'm starting services, like, there could be just so many valuable resources of people that maybe have been working with the kid for at least the whole school year, if not longer. A lot of times special ed, you know, you have K through 2, 3 through 5. So they potentially have been with this kid for a few years. So that's just like such a wealth of information that we can tap into.
Yes, it's like every child you meet with that has their surrounding people. Like every time I meet another BCD, I'm like, wow, she has so much to say. She has so much to offer. And everyone really, based on their personal experiences and their personal education of how they perceive the different education, because even if you go to the same courses as a lot of people, everyone takes it in a different way, and hearing how they come in, it's just like a way to like build on your knowledge. And it really is fascinating when you take advantage of it. Like you become so much greater in what you do. So it's such a key factor in like building your own wealth, personnel of information, and being able to bring out the best of the child, hearing their personal interaction with their child and their overall success, which for sure is huge.
Totally.
I want to jump into like another, I think is a very hot topic, specifically for parents. I know we know the parents we deal with all the time have a hard time with it, honestly, which is the IEP. And when BCBAs could be there to support the parents through the experience, I think it's really, whether it's like the BCBA's first time or not, I would love for you to say, what do you think is important for BCBAs to support the parents when it comes to IEP, and how to like, and where should the BCBAs really look at the IEP where they could offer their guidance?
The third surprise word is white.
Totally. So I think, you know, if the parents are coming to you for feedback on the IEP, I've had that before where, you know, there's a period of time when the school sends the parent the IEP, they can, you know, bring up any revisions, things like that. I've had parents send it over to me and say, hey, is there anything, you know, that comes up? So for just that example, I think it's really important to look at the goals. So, you know, there's a section of the IEP that has like the emotional, social, behavioral goals for the child. So I would say, you know, focus on that area. You know, that's within our scope. And I would take a look at whatever skills that the client may be working on in school that either overlap with, or you've seen evidence of, or you know is an area of need for your client. So an example of that I can give is one of my clients was working on toileting at home. And he was actually really successful with it. So he was able to go independently, but that manned component of it was missing for him. And he didn't have a ton of language, but we're still working on a point to a picture for it. And then within his IEP, they didn't have anything regarding, you know, manding, communication for toileting. It was just, you know, the basic toileting goal. So with that, I told mom, hey, I think we should tweak that a little bit, or bring it up to them that this should specifically include a component about manding, because it was something that she was really concerned about. She wanted to make sure he had that skill. And the school was putting him on an interval schedule, which is also very common with toileting. And just that's how they ran most of the classroom. So I gave her that feedback, and the school was super open to it. They were grateful for that, to see the insight that, you know, this is the data that I had on it. This is how we've been working on it at home. And this is, I even rephrased the goal just as an example, right? I was like, hey, this is an option for you if you can incorporate it this way. And they were more than happy to do that. So I would say, yeah, definitely aligning it to what data you have, what experience you have with the client, and then taking in, you know, the parents' feedback as well.
What else would you recommend for BCBAs? Because that's a very important point. And the parents thankfully knew to ask you. How much do you think, yes, like, how much do you think the BCBA should put themselves out there and saying, like, listen, like, I'm your child's, like, BCBA provider, and I want to get involved. Like, how do you think parents would take to that, and how do you think the best way for a BCBA to do that is?
Yeah, usually, so usually I'll start with, I don't, when I'm first, like, meeting with a parent, I don't bring it up in the first conversation typically. So if the parent, you know, doesn't have that on their radar at all, usually by like the second or third parent training session, I'll say like, okay, hey, we've been having some sessions now, and I'll get a feel for the client. I'll say, you know, we've been working for 3 or 4 weeks with sessions at home. I would love to see a copy of their IEP if you're willing to share. Because most of the time in the intake, you know, you can see that, you know, what the basic school setting is, what other services they have. And then at that point, I'll feel comfortable asking them for the IEP. 9 times out of 10, the parents are more than happy to share it. They're totally okay with that. And then I'll take a look at it. And if the IEP is really looking like super solid, like there's not a ton of feedback for me, usually I'll just say like, thank you. And, you know, if there's any way that I can support for school services, please let me know. Sometimes I'll take a look at it and say like, ooh, that's a really cool skill that they're still not showing at home. You know, maybe I'll ask the parent like, hey, would you be okay with me reaching out to, the SLP at school just to get their take on this? And usually they're also okay with that, and they'll provide me the information. I always make sure that we have like consent to share information and consent to contact, of course, on file. Most of the time that's filled out already at the beginning, but usually, yeah, it'll go one of two ways, but at the very bare minimum, I like to have a copy of the IEP and at least let the parents know that I'm available to support if they need it. And then if I see that a reevaluation meeting is coming up soon too, as well on the date, I can say like, hey, if you want me to join in any way, you know, I'm happy to. So kind of leaving it up to the parents, right? They are like the bridge in that sense. Some parents really want it. Some are like, no, we're okay. We're happy with it. Like, no need. So it depends.
Mm-hmm. Do you often join the IEP meetings, or do you think you could get enough by reviewing it after? Like, I'm just curious.
I would say like 50-50. So it depends. Some parents really want you there. Other times they just more so want review and feedback, and they're okay to just like pass it along. I would say it also depends on if the parent is newer to like the whole autism world, or if they're newer, sometimes they want more support. But yeah, if they've been in it for a little bit, sometimes they're like, they got it. And I'm like, all right.
Is it as long as they got it? Because in my experience, from what I've been hearing from parents, it's like, it's a really difficult journey for them.
Yeah.
For sure, for the new ones. Like, just knowing. Yes. They don't really, I don't know how educated parents are in like what they could ask for and where they could put their foot down and how many tweaks they could make, et cetera. Like, have you ever found
like
the parents to be like kind of really just leading, like following the school in the lead and just not just accepting whatever they say?
Totally. I do think that's very easy to fall into that because, you know, the school has their own requirements, right? And they have their different classrooms and all of these different things that they have to look out for. And of course, you know, they always have the child's interest in mind. But I think, you know, a lot of parents, especially if you're new to it, you don't have all of the background in like any of the special education laws, like least restrictive environment, like all of these different things. that are probably overwhelming, to be honest, like if you're just still learning about it. So I'm always happy to like provide resources too for the parents, like send them resources, you know, let them know that they can always have an advocate as well with them in a meeting, different things like that.
It's really amazing how much happens in school and how much happens at home, and like how it really could be totally two separate situations, like how a child could get engaged completely differently at home and then at school. And it's just like, it's really crazy to see it. Like,
mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, the differences, totally. That's why I always love to get a little bit of insight on it, because it's like just like a window into like the rest of their day, the rest of their functioning.
Totally. It's like two different personas, but like, I even feel like growing up in a way, like I remember like you kind of present yourself differently. You're in a school setting, you're surrounded by friends. Really? It's like it brings out a totally different aspect of you and like brings out different strengths. And at home, you have other strengths and different weaknesses. And then, mm-hmm. you know, like when like you hear like, well, he really could do that. I don't believe it. It's really interesting to like mm-hmm. look at the child.
Yeah, it's a totally different environment. And even like the family system, like all of that impacts the home as well. So, you know, so, and sometimes we do see that behavioral contrast where it's like, you know, the kid really did so well all day and then they come home and they're like, oh, right. And you might see more behaviors, right? Like right. They're in their safe space. So like that can be a factor as well. Totally.
Right. And even like, just like the pressure at school or, mm-hmm. and then they come home and it's their time to just like, leave me alone. I don't want to follow any rules now. I came home full day. I'm done, you know?
Yeah, I always consider that. And when designing programs for home, I'm like, some kids, especially the younger ones, like if they've been working all day, like they probably need a lot of play-based programming because right. like developmentally, it's just, that's a lot for them to be sitting at a table and all that. So I'm like, they've been working hard.
Totally. And it only just this idea of how a child really is different at home and in school just reinforces this whole collaboration piece that why it's important. And thank you so much for bringing us to the table. Before we close, is there anything else you feel you want to offer to let our listeners know?
Yeah, I think we pretty much covered everything. The only other thing I would offer is just some resources that I think are really helpful. So if you're ever finding yourself in a school as a BCBA, NJ.gov has a whole website and a whole super long document on best practices for school BCBAs. So I really like that because it talks about, you know, the different New Jersey laws, like basically outlines all of the best practices for FBAs. It's a great resource. Okay. And then there's also NJABA Public School Work Group. So I found that helpful, especially when starting in schools, just to have a bit of a community. Sometimes it can be isolating. To be a BCBA, you might find yourself being the only BCBA in the school, or potentially if you're consulting in, you might not have like a huge wealth of resources at your fingertips. So that can be helpful with just connecting you to other practitioners in the state. And then another website I use all the time is PBIS World. So that breaks down all ABA interventions by the tiers. So we didn't get too much into that, but there's like tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3 interventions, and it has lists and examples of all of them. So the first person that showed me that, I was like, wow, this is incredible. So I just wanted to share.
Thank you.
Those three. Yeah.
And I'll put those links in the show notes so people can easily access them. Perfect. Thank you so much, Samantha.
Yeah.
It was so enjoyable to listen to you, and you offered so much. So thank you really for your time.
Yeah, this was awesome. I appreciate it.